Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Just how vulnerable do you think you are to scams? You might think that you're not the type of person who falls for internet scams, but it turns out there is no type of person who falls for these things. They range across all incomes, ages, and professions. My guests for you today are two people who know this. Brian Hay is a detective superintendent with the Queensland Police Service, and he's the head of its Fraud and Corporate Crime Group. And there are similar organisations pretty much right across Australia. His job is to investigate the ever-flourishing culture of online and phone scams. And they go way beyond the standard once-in-a-lifetime, too-good-to-be-true offer of Nigerian gold, as you're about to find out. The people who practice this kind of fraud are amazingly good at picking at your vulnerabilities. And they often leave those who've fallen for their scams so embarrassed and ashamed they don't even report that they've been had. Joan Harrington is one of the few with the courage who's happy to tell her story. Joan was taken in by a particularly nasty type of scheme that's called romance fraud. Joan is now part of a support group that's been set up by Brian Hay here that helps people get over the corrosive experience of being taken for a ride on such a cold-blooded way. And just so you know, Joan's no wide-eyed innocent to the ways of the criminal world. She's actually a retired prison officer. Hello, Joan, and hello, Brian. Nice to have you here.
Good morning.
Brian, first of all, let me start with you. Why are people so reluctant to come forward in these matters?
You know, I think it's we've got this awful stigma in the community, and it's you hear it all the time. Oh, people say they judge others, and they say, oh, they must be stupid or greedy because I think I wouldn't fall for such a scam or a fraud. And that's the furthest thing from the truth. I can tell you now, it's got nothing to do with intelligence. It's got nothing to do with greed. If you are approached at the right time in your life, you will fall victim to a fraud. It's all about the pitch. It's all about the vulnerabilities, your emotional state, what you're looking for. If you are approached with the right story at the right time in your life, you too could end up in the same position of thousands, or actually tens of thousands of others.
Now, Joan, you're here because you want to ring a warning bell, don't you? You want other people to know what you've been through.
I do, and I worry that what I've been through, that others are going to go through, and we just want to get it out there that it's so easy to be gotten, and I want to be at the forefront with the fraud squad to let people know that, hey, think about it first. Don't anybody ask you for money, don't give it. If you feel you're being defrauded, please go to ring up the fraud squad. They're a great mob here in Brisbane or anywhere in Australia. And let them know that you have a feeling about something.
Yes, you've got to trust that feeling, don't you?
You've got to, yes.
We'll go into the details in a minute of how you went through, because it's fascinating. I'm just kind of fascinated also by the fact that you are a former prison guard, and prison guards are kind of experts, I would have thought, in someone who's trying to have a lend of you, trying to get around this, trying to sort of bend your ear, trying to fool you, persuade you. So it really can happen to anyone, can't it?
It can. I saw one of my ex-inmates in a shopping centre, and I told him I'd been scammed. And he said, not you. He said, of all people, not you. He said, we couldn't pull any wool over your eyes. How come that you were scammed? And I said, well, it was by somebody I don't know.
Well, that's it. Brian, tell me how you got this job at the head of the Fraud and Corporate Crime Group.
Well, it was out of the blue, really. I was sitting down minding my own business at the CMC, of all places, and I was looking to get out. I've done about six tours of duty with anti-corruption fighting. And I saw an advertisement, there was an expression of interest for a a position in the rural, the stock squad. And I thought, oh, well, that's a change of course. So I put that in, but I got a phone call saying, would I go and head up the fraud? And the rest is history.
You're hooked now, aren't you? This is particularly satisfying work for a policeman, isn't it?
Look, I find it extremely satisfying, you know, and the steps we've made over the last 7 years have been enormous. We're regarded extremely highly around the world for the work that we're doing now. And I'm happy to see out my time and if the my policing career doing this work, because you go home, you've done a hard day's yakka, you meet wonderful people, you've made a difference to their lives. And to me, that's what policing's all about, making a difference.
Now, you said you made the point that it can happen to anyone. We're talking about people who have had tertiary education, no tertiary education. You know, just how well educated can people who fall victim to these things be?
Well, if you look at the average profile of the business investment scheme, now the average loss is about $350,000 per individual.
Whoa.
So you're talking a person over the age of 45 years, tertiary qualified, professional in their life, or very successful in business, their own businesses. These are people that have gone the hard yards on day-in-day grindings and negotiations of being successful. We're talking about university professors, lawyers, accountants, financial planners, teachers. There's no barrier.
Financial planners, people whose job it is to understand complex financial schemes.
Absolutely.
Can fall for these things.
Absolutely. No one is immune.
$350,000, Joan, you feel you got off easy now after hearing that?
I think so, yeah. It sounds like it.
How broken do people get by this experience?
Oh, extremely broken. And, you know, suicide is a real issue. That's an agenda item that we need to look more closely at. I've been having conversations with the National Institute for Suicide Prevention and try and develop some programs and do some research in this area. I've received letters and emails where the last one was told a story how they walked on the edge of a dam and they were thinking about taking that one more step because that would be the end of their pain. And that's the sad part that we touched on. Everyone's vulnerable, but there's this stigma associated with it. You can't come out and tell anyone because they're going to point fingers at you and denigrate you. You're going to be accused of being stupid and greedy. And it gets my blood running because it makes me so cranky because it is not the truth. And by maligning these people, we force them into a corner and they cannot get the support that they need. They can't discuss it, perhaps not even with relatives who will ridicule them for wasting money or whatever. And everything's in a negative context. So the reality is we have got, as I said, tens and thousands of people falling victim to these insidious crimes. And they don't utter a sound. None of these people came to us. We went to them. And we established...
You go to them?
We went to them. No one... Very few come knocking on our door. Back, it was about... We first started... We had a debate in my office. And is the Nigerian fraud fact or myth? Is it just one of these urban myths? Because we checked our records. We didn't have a single complaint. So I said, well, rightio, let's do this. Let's reach out to 26 people. Pick these names. Find out why did they send money to Nigeria. Of the 26 people, 25 were victims. Some had been sending money for in excess of 10 years, and they'd lost about $7.2 million. So we expanded that and said, right, outlets, and we expanded that to 139 people. Out of 139 people, 134 were victims, and they'd lost in excess of $21 million. A couple of years later, the most recent study that we did, we looked at 200 people. Why did you send money to Nigeria? Now, you've got to understand, this is just a window. It's a snapshot. Of 200 people, 186 were victims. Now, they lost again, you know, in the tens of millions. And virtually none of them ever made a complaint to police.
So in that, it's the perfect crime. It's a perfect crime in that sense, unless you go and knock on their door, that person's door. Okay, so it can be best seen then as the full monstrosity, if that's the word I'm looking for, of the crime can be seen when you see it as a cascading crime. So there's the fraud. Money is taken. But beyond that, you might have suicide, and therefore family members are affected beyond that, and then there's homelessness, and then there's depression, and the effects are felt by other people around the scam. It's kind of big ripples in the pond there.
Absolutely. You know, I can give you an example where you get a syndicate of people involved, because all your money runs out, then you need to go to your friends, your relatives, and those that you trust to offer them opportunities, and that's because you believe this to be an opportunity. And you get their money involved, so that investment of emotion is getting greater all the time. And so what happens is that you become dependent on them for their money. You're sharing their dream with you. And when you go down the, if you go down the tube, you don't want it to be false. You have to believe, because you've got other people now involved, people who are depending on you. And
it sounds like a gambling mania. It's like, you know, I've lost all my money, but if I one more go on the wheel or the poker machine, then I'll make my money back.
And it's interesting you say that. I'll give you one example. We did a story with 60 Minutes some years ago. It was the big sting. The next day, on Monday morning, I got a phone call from a gentleman in Victoria, and he said, Brian, he said, I just want to tell you a story. I think I might be a victim as well. And I said, what's your name? He said, John. I said, please speak, John. And he told me his yarn, and I said, mate, I had to tell you this, John, but you are, in fact, a victim. And I said, can you do me a favour? He said, what's that? I said, can you please not send any more money? Because most people do, would you believe? And he said, Brian, I've got nothing left to send. I said, how much have you sent? He said, 800,000. And I said, well, look, please. I said, they'll still come after you. Please do not send any more money. He said, I promise you I won't. The very next day, I got a phone call. And it's from John. I said, g'day, mate, how are you going? He said, Brian, I've got to tell you something. I said, what's that? He said, I've just sent another $250. I said, John, why did you do that? He said, Brian, they said the money was in an account in Hong Kong. It was the final payment required. And after sending $800,000, what was another $250? Now, I actually can understand the logic that he was applying in those circumstances. But that's the mindset. You are. It's not something like they call you once or they have one communication. You are constantly bombarded with attention and these communications. It's, you know, the old term brainwashing. You are put into a mindset that is no longer yours, it's theirs.
You see, I see you nodding, Joan, and as you're telling me, I'm sort of kind of overwhelmed with waves of disgust almost. It's such a disgusting thing that's being perpetrated. No wonder people don't speak. I kind of feel that now. I kind of get a sense that that's so disgusting and awful. Yeah. I mean, were you feeling similarly affronted then, Joan?
Well, yeah. Well, see, they'd ring you in the middle of the night because of the time difference. And it'd break your sleep up, and say 2 o'clock in the morning, and then they'd speak in this African accent that is very hard to understand, and they won't take no for an answer, and they push and push and push, and they bring in God and all that sort of thing, like the gods have sent you to us, help us, you know. But the pushing at you never stops. And you think you're right. You think, oh, well, this will be the last, and righto, well, I'll send that. But
Brian, once you fall for these things, does your name then appear on some kind of victims list, or some kind of a list that's then used by scammers? It was interchanged by scammers?
Absolutely. It's called a sucker's list. Mm. And it becomes your name then becomes a commodity in research.
Sorry, is that your name for it, or is that the scammer's name for it?
That's the scammer's name for it. And your name is a commodity that is traded like gold. And other scammers will pay it for your details, and you will be contacted again without a doubt. And research shows that 60% of people who fall for one fraud will fall a second time.
Mm. Often fraud cases will prey on people's desire to get rich quick, and sometimes these are people without much money, and so you can see why that happens. But romance fraud is a growing area here, and this is what I want to bring you in, Joan, which is something that preys on someone's desire for companionship, which I think is particularly nasty. Let's get a bit of a sense of where you were, Joan, when all this started to happen. You had a job in a prison that you loved, didn't you?
Yes.
And what was the nature of your job as a?
Well, I worked in the village part of the prison as an officer.
Oh, it's the low security part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, it was medium security, but it was teaching inmates how to look after themselves, and they did their washing and their cleaning and their cooking, and it was in housing and inside the main prison. But it was, I was Auntie Joan, Grandma, Mum, you know, to these fellas. And I was squeezed out by management because I said no to a couple of things, and you're not supposed to do that. So
you said no to some things you thought were improper, actually.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Well,
that were being put to you that weren't quite right.
Yeah.
And so you were kind of squeezed out, as you say.
I was.
How did the prisoners react once they found out you were leaving?
Devastated, because other officers tried to emulate what I did, and the inmates told them to get out of the area because you're not Joan. Bring Joan back, we'll listen to her. but we won't have anything to do with someone that's trying to act like her. So either treat us like we're criminals or get out, because Joan treated us fairly.
So after being squeezed out, you probably weren't in the best state of mind, were you, because it was horribly unfair by the sound of things?
Well, it was terrible. I told them I was retiring just so I didn't get a mark against me of them actually sacking me. So I just said I was retiring. For a year, I couldn't write. I hardly spoke to a person. I couldn't hold a pen to do my crosswords. I was an absolute mess because I was only 61. And that's far too early to retire from, especially from a job that you really love. Holidays would come around and I'd cut the holidays short just to go back to work. I couldn't stay away.
Could you get another job? Oh, 61, it's not easy, is it?
I got another job as a cleaner, a night cleaner, just 4 hours a night.
But you don't work with people there, do you, very
no,
much?
No. Toilet cleaning is a lot different to being a prison officer. But that was very degrading. But then my daughter said to me, look at it this way, you're a retired correctional officer that is working as a cleaner to supplement your pension.
Were any of your kids living with you at that stage, Joan?
Yes. My youngest son moved out to start his life, but my eldest son decided to come home to Mum after being in the Navy for 10 years, and he didn't bring a knapsack over his shoulder like all the Navy people do. He lived off base and he brought a truck of 52 items. And so everything was double in my house then. So he's been with me since 2000.
Now, around about this time, it sounds like you've recovered a bit and you were ready to give internet dating a go. And for that, I say good on you because, you know, I know people who've got married as a result of internet dating.
Yeah.
So it's not always like this, but you're ready to give it a go.
Every person, no matter who they are, wants to be loved by somebody and wants to love somebody. So you keep on trying. I'm still keeping on trying, but I'm very careful.
I reckon. Did you know anything about scamming that was taking place in some of these online dating sites?
No. Until I actually heard from these people and I started to think, oh, that sounds too good to be true. And after two or three weeks, they're saying, oh, I love you and everything. Believe that, yeah. So I started looking up 149.
149
on a computer, and I thought, you know, especially when they asked for $50 to start with.
Right.
And I thought, you know, the brain started to work, and I looked up that, and I Googled the person's name, and I looked on the Google World, and yes, there was an address of that sort in America,
Let me ask you first then about how you met Mark.
I met Mark.
In inverted commas, that's...
You can't believe it's the same person, that it is Mark.
So tell me how he made Mark is,
well,
made contact with you.
The first thing that happened was I was on the site and up comes a little message at the top and it says, hello, lovely lady, I'd love to meet you and I'm a black man. And I immediately said, what would you want with me? I'm a white woman. I live in Australia. Get off. So I clicked him off. And I thought, what's he want, you know? And then next thing, Mark came on and he said, yeah, hello, how are you and all that sort of thing. And I live in America, in Texas. And I said, just like the person before you, and I went off at him. I said, isn't there any nice women in America? Why would you want to come to Australia for a woman older than you? And he said, that's a terrible thing to say, you know. And then I said, sorry. That was my mistake. I said, sorry. Go ahead. And we talked for quite a long time. And then over several weeks, months.
What did he explain to you about himself, Joan?
He said he was his wife had died and that he had a 10-year-old son And he was looking for a loving, caring woman, and he liked my profile and thought I was that woman that he was looking for to be a mother to his son.
Because when you put your profile, you really put the best of you on display, don't you?
Of course. You can tell a lot of lies, but I don't. Yeah, I should start lying, though. But, yeah, you do put that forward, and they use every little word. They asked about my, he asked about my family, and I told him about my family, and he wanted to know what sort of work my daughter did, and I told him, and she must be making money, so, you know, and she'd be well off and happy in a way. And I said, oh, yes, she is, you know, and I went along with all that sort of thing.
My guests in conversation today are the head of the Queensland Fraud Squad, Detective Superintendent Brian Hay, and Joan Harrington, who's one of the few people prepared to stand up and speak up about her experience of romance fraud. So you had this conversation with Mark, in inverted commas, for quite some time before he asked you for anything at all then, and he was quite charming.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
What was the story he told you about having to go overseas?
He said he was a gold merchant and that he had to go over to England for business. And he said he'd come to me after being in England because he wanted to meet me and bring his son. So
to Australia. He was he was going to come to Australia.
So he went to England. He sent me the copies of the tickets that he got from near his place in Texas to England and went via Holland or something. And then all of a sudden his son got sick in England, and I was sympathetic. And he was saying, oh, well, I'll have to sell my computer and my roaming mobile phone and all that. And I said, oh, poor you, you know, sorry, I can't help. And then he said he had a farm in Africa, in Ghana. His overseer, he will get me to get in touch with the overseer, and we can talk too about farming and whatnot. So I... Next thing, I got a phone email from his overseer. And then Mark then said, oh, the overseer has broken his mobile phone. Could you possibly send over $50 to him?
Okay, now I want to bring Brian at this point. Often it seems like the first thing that a scammer will ask for is really quite a small amount of money. It's kind of a gateway.
It all depends. It may not be. Quite often the first thing might be a large amount of money if they think you can afford it. By this stage, they've already worked out what Joan's financial capacity may be, how she could possibly get money from her children, and they're testing the water. For example, if Joan had owned a lot of assets, had significant wealth, then the first incident may have been a phone call you received from... the Ghana General Hospital that says, I'm Dr. Joe Bloggs. This gentleman has been brought in here after a car crash. He requires emergency life-saving surgery. We're a poor hospital. It needs to be funded. It'll cost $50,000. Are you interested in saving this man's life? So it all depends on the individual circumstances and what they can glean from the profile and the questioning that you go through.
Joe, I noticed he back-footed you right at the start when you said, oh, yeah, I don't believe your story. And he said, oh, what a terrible thing to say. Mm. So you had this kind of, I suppose, in the back of your mind, this slightly guilty feeling for not having trusted him initially then. A slight feeling of like, oh, I wasn't a very nice thing I said to this person when I didn't trust this person.
Well, I didn't trust it at first, but then when it all started unravelling, or not ravelling, ravelling is a word, I felt sorry for them and I wanted to help.
So how did it escalate from there? He wanted $50 for, what was it,
for
mobile
the
phone?
Right, mobile phone, because his cattle were suddenly sick, had some disease, and I wrote to the overseer and I said, well, if you've got that sort of disease in Africa in your farm, you should shoot the lot of them. And he thought that was a terrible thing to say. You know, we want to save our cattle. And I said, well, if we have a disease here in Australia, if we had foot and mouth, we would kill those animals and maybe burn them and bury them. Why are you... the photos I got of the cattle were all these Brahmins, and they were in pens. and
that could have been anywhere.
And and standing in mud, and then all around the outside of the pens is beautiful green grass. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't they put them in the green grass? But Mark, in the meantime, in England, said that his money. I said, you're a businessman, get out of there, pay your son's bill, and get out of there. And he said, I can't because my money's frozen in America. Because last time I went overseas, somebody got my money out of the bank, defrauded me. And he said, I wouldn't let that happen again. He said, I thought I'd budgeted enough for this trip until my cattle got sick.
So there's a story for everything here. This is I'm amazed by how tailored it is to you as well. Like, you get these generic emails, but really you've got a guy who's really working on you very, very full on, in a very full on way here.
Yeah.
So at that point, how much money did he want then sent to
him? Nothing at that time. He went to Africa.
It was an
England mobile. He rang me once, and then it got to Ghana.
Conversations with Richard Feidler, on air, online, and podcast.
Today you're hearing the story of cybercrime, if you like, fraud, scams that are conducted over through the internet or via the phone. And with me at the moment is Joan Harrington, who was taken in by a particularly nasty kind of romance fraud, and Detective Superintendent Brian Hay, head of Queensland's Fraud and Corporate Crime Group. We'll pick up your story in just a moment, but I just wanted to go to you, Brian, and ask you, how big is romance fraud? How quickly is this growing?
Look, it's growing alarmingly. When we did our first set of figures a bit over 3 years ago, romance fraud accounted for about 7%. 3 years later, out of our group of 200 people, 70%, nearly 70% of them were victims of romance fraud. So that's 1,000% growth in 3 years.
Joan, when did this Mark person, or whoever the Mark is, make a big play for you? What was the big play that was put to you when Mark started asking for some serious money?
Well, it was then put on to the overseer, because when he got to Ghana, he was supposed to be going to the bank to get a loan because his money was frozen in America. On the way to the bank, he collapsed, and they had to take him to a private hospital.
This is the story that was being fed to you.
Yeah,
right?
This was the story. So the overseer told me that he'd collapsed. And would it be possible, because I'm broke and the cattle are dying and my boss can't pay me, would it be possible for you to send over a little bit of money to start his treatment, because foreigners in our country don't get treated unless the money is up front? So my doctor is Nigerian, so I asked him about this, and he said, oh, that's true. He said, they won't treat you if you're a foreigner unless you have full travel insurance, which I thought a businessman would have to have.
So this, again, they get the story was right, if you know what I mean. Like, they're not just throwing out nonsense.
No.
This is a well-rehearsed, carefully prepared story that checks out if you choose to check it out. So what did you do then, Joan?
So I sent $200 after a lot of pushing at me. I sent $200 to start it off, to start his treatment, because by then I thought this man was going to change my life.
How did he ask the money to be sent to him?
What is it? Western Union.
Through Western Union, yeah. So you cabled it, in other words.
And it's in American dollars. So it was $200 plus to send it by Western Union to American dollars. Now it wouldn't be with our economy, but at that time, yes.
So this is a commonplace practice. They'll ask you to wire them money through something like Western Union, right?
It's never through a bank.
Never through a bank?
Well, in all these cases that we've spoken of, it's 100% has been cash remittance agencies have transferred and wired the money overseas.
So once you sent the money, Joan, what happened then?
Well, they said he started treatment. So he was in hospital, you see. And then I was getting... the overseer said to me, my mother lived in Melbourne in Australia. And he said, she came home to Africa for a visit and she died here. and she left $5.8 million. She didn't want it spent in Africa because Australia was her home then, and you can have a percentage of that money if you would send over the tax to get it out of the country, and then you can send me back what you like or whatever, you know. And I thought,
classic gold scam. This is it, yeah. The classic scam. Yes.
So I thought, how idiotic. So I showed my, I don't want to bring my son into this really, but I said I showed my son the email. And he immediately thought, well, that sounds good. I was saying, but, you know, sending them money and how I didn't know how much then at one time. So I said to the, I can't send money. I don't have money. Mark knows I don't have money. Oh, but this way I'll get you onto the bank accountant. So next thing I'm getting these phone calls and emails from the bank accountant, and he's saying it would only cost you $5,800 from the $5.8 million to pay the tax, and then it can be sent to you. And I said, well, why don't you pay the tax out of the $5.8 million? Why do I have to send you that money up front? And so they wanted to speak to Stefan, my son, because he's a man. They didn't want to talk to a woman, because a woman knows nothing about business. So they wanted to talk to the man. So I put them on to my son, and he was flabbergasted by how much the language got to him, because he's, you know, the African language, and he couldn't understand it properly. So he was sort of giving in because he couldn't understand what they were saying. And he'd say, you talk to my mother. Oh, no, we want to talk to a man about this. Now, his phone calls were and emails were, we'll get the, if you send this, we'll send you the documents first, and that'll show that this money has been paid, and then you might have to pay for money laundering laws over here to stop money being laundered. So they sent me the documents via email, and I copied them out. And I don't know why, if other people copy them out, but they were astounded that I copied them out, and I've still got them. Every email that was sent to and fro has been copied.
Brian, what Joan's talking about here, she's mentioning a guy called Mark, who was the romantic contact initially through the online dating site. The overseer who's running this guy's farm, apparently, and now there's an accountant. What's likely happening? Are they all the same people, these three people? Paint us a picture of what's really most likely happening. I know you probably can't know for sure, but what's most likely really going on from wherever this scam's coming from?
Look, they will be working by themselves to get the person where they want them, and they'll be telling them a list of stories. Then they'll need to bring in others to help validate the story. So you'll get different voices on the phone. Then they'll work together. Now, if they need to have money sent to the UK as part of their story, either they'll travel to the UK themselves or they'll have another part of their clique take that money, keep a percentage and forward it back on their behalf. To give you an idea, when we looked at the business investment frauds, we found for every dollar that went to Nigeria, there was $1.04 going to one of 41 other countries. The Nigerian problem is not in Nigeria. It is across the world. It is global.
So it's really then most likely to be three guys sitting in a room with some computers in the north of England or somewhere in the world. We don't really know where. Who are sort of working together, and they're running several schemes at the same time.
Absolutely. It's very well organised. And we've got to understand that it is organised, it's global, and it's networked. And it's very, very effective.
John, your son borrowed some money to pay for this. In the end, how much money all up did you send?
$15,000.
$15,000. And
might just say, we often see the escalation. Okay, they start out with one entry point. They get the confidence. The test was 200. They worked out that Joan didn't have any more of the money themselves. They created a new story to build up, and they reached out to other members of the family. And we'll often then, they'll work out the circle of support and the potential what could be leached out in terms of money from that from your group, and they'll create another story that may appeal to those other members.
Joan, did you ever speak to Prince Charming on the phone? Mark, Mr. Wonderful, did you ever actually speak in person to him?
I only spoke to him once when he was in England. Twice I spoke to him, but once, the first time was when he was in England and he wanted me to get online. He said, "You're not online, you're not ready for me." And he was quite bitter, you know. And he said, "You must always be online for me." And I said, "At this time of night, you know, I'm not online." Anyway, I could hardly understand him, and I thought, well, he's supposed to be Maori, or from New Zealand, and all Australians can understand the Maoris, their New Zealand speech, so I thought, oh, that doesn't sound good. But anyway, it was sort of this whining-type voice. The second time that I actually spoke to him was when he was supposedly lying in the hospital, and Courage, the overseer, took the mobile phone to him so I could talk to him. And I said, because how come I'm not hearing from Mark anymore? I'm only hearing from you or the accountant. And he said, oh, well, my boss is so sick, you know, and can't talk. So I said, well, I'm not doing anything until I talk to Mark. So they put him on at the supposed hospital, and it was the same whiny voice. And I said, I don't want to do this. This is all a scam. And he said, no, 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 no. He said, as soon as I get out of here, I will be over to see you. And he's cough, 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 this, you know. And I said, what, have you got TB or something? He said, oh, it could be. I don't know. And I thought, well, I don't want TB coming into Australia anyway.
John, I suppose what really is amazing about this is that, again, you're not, every step of the way, you're still going, this doesn't sound right. This doesn't sound right. And your friends must have been warning you about this too, that you were being scammed. When did the penny drop? When did you realise that you knew for sure you were being scammed?
Well, they sent me several documents of money that we'd paid. And then they sent me another document saying, you have to pay this one. And it was one that we'd already paid. That's when the penny dropped.
Your son willing to believe at the time that...
Oh,
to persuade him?
Yeah. I walked into his room several times during this and I said, I've just been on the computer and I don't like what I'm seeing. And he said, do not bring negative thoughts into my room. So it was a case of I'm fighting this on my own. He's supplying the money, but I'm fighting it on my own and I need help.
Doesn't that sum it up? Do not bring negative thoughts into this room. Such a common thought, isn't it?
Very much so, and it really emphasises the fact that, you know, we found that 76% of people continue to send money after we as law enforcement people came into their lives and tell them this is a fraud, a scam, do not send any more money. They continue to do so because people live in hope. We're almost pre-programmed to try our luck and we look for that amazing opportunity. And we're knocking on the door saying, you know, the dream you've had for the last 3 years and invested $750,000? Well, it's actually a nightmare. We're going to take it and shatter it in a million pieces against the wall. And then we figure out, why won't they believe us? Because they don't want to.
Once you'd said, let him said, hey, I'm onto you, mate. What happened then? Did he contact you after that? Did Prince Charming keep in touch with you after that?
I sent a very nasty email stating exactly what I thought of him and of Courage and of the accountant and
Courage
everything
being
else.
The interesting name for the overseer
i.e.
the bloke sitting next to him in this office. And
well, his name was Courage Glover Jr. And the name of the accountant was John Mensah. So if anybody's getting these scam things over in the dating things or anything, remember those names.
And contact your local police fraud squad immediately.
And Mark Dell was the name of the person that contacted me in the first place, DEL. So just be aware that these names could be used again for other people.
I should say, if anyone's listening who's completely innocent, who's called Mark Dell, But,
no, he's a foreigner. So
some guy from on the other side of the world who wants your money.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
normal Mark, any other Mark Dell, you're fine. No. Just better point that out. As I get an angry phone call from someone called Mark about this. After you cut off contact with him, you saw him again. He popped up on the dating site, didn't he?
I heard from him before then, stating that he sent me an email saying that he'd gotten a third party. I'm now home in America. He's gotten a third party in Australia to get all that money out for Courage, and that you're no longer needed for this, and you've been so negative during this whole time that I don't think I want you to be a mother of my son.
Oh, it's all your fault, Joan.
It is my fault.
It's all your fault. If you hadn't been just so mean.
Yeah. But anyway, I still belong to this site, although I didn't pay for it, but I'd still go through, and they have a click score, like someone that's really ideal for you. And there he is again, and I'd already told the site that he had defrauded me, and they said, oh, well, we'll wipe him off, we'll keep an eye out, and we won't let him on.
But they didn't.
They didn't. So he came on again and saying he was a living in Brisbane, had two daughters to a divorced. He was divorced from his wife and loved my profile and everything else. And he tried again. So I then again sent a message to the site saying he's on again. And they said, well, we'll look into that. And then I sent another email, and the emails were still going, so he's had that address.
So he's still trolling around,
yeah.
And despite repeated warnings. Has he been taken off now?
I don't. I haven't looked for a long time, and if he did go on now, he wouldn't use his photo.
Two guests with me today on Conversations, Joan Harrington, taken in by a particularly nasty kind of romance fraud, and Detective Superintendent Brian Hay, who's a very senior policeman who's in charge of combating this sort of crime. Yeah. How responsive are these dating sites to when they're being warned that there are these trolls lurking about trying to scam people of their money?
Look, some are better than others. Some have worked with us right from the outset to try and reduce the victimisation on their sites and allowing the crooks to get on there in the first place, because there are some screening processes you can put in place. For example, IP addresses that are registered in Nigeria might be a bit of a warning sign.
Sounds like this lot were pretty slow on the uptake, weren't they, Brian? Do they need to get a warning from you or from customers?
Well, they should listen to their customers. Yeah. Absolutely.
What effect has this had on you emotionally, Joan?
Oh, emotionally bad. Brian was talking about suicide a while ago. I didn't get that far. I got so depressed that I thought, oh, what's the use of going on? But I have no belief in suicide whatsoever. I think it's a terrible thing to do that to your family. So it was my family that kept me going. But you get terribly, terribly depressed and you think, oh, all I wanted to do was help. And they've done that to me, you know. And
was it hard to tell your friends what had happened?
To admit it, yeah, what they knew all along. To actually admit it, yes, I've been scammed and you were right. And one thing about it, my best friends were sympathetic and they said, Joan, we're sorry. We tried to warn you, but we're sorry, you know. Others said, well, you wouldn't listen to us. It's your own stupid fault. So it was the same as when I left the prison, how I was dejected and sad and sorry about all that. It came back again.
You find out who your friends are then?
You do. You do. You do.
How are you stuck financially now, though? You took out a loan.
My son's paying off the loans, and that's why he's gone over to the other side of the country to try and make money to pay his loans. It hasn't been easy between my son and I for a long time because we were sort of holding it in, both of us, until actually the anger started. It's like a grieving process. It's like losing a parent or a sibling or something, and you you go through how many grieving processes until you get to the anger, and the anger is good. Because once you're angry, then you can turn around and you can say, hey, you rotten cows, you did this to me, and from now on I'm going to try and stop them from doing it to anybody else. That's why I'm in the group with the fraud squad, and we want to let everybody know, come on, this is happening. And a lady that at our last group said that we weren't just victims, that in our group we were now survivors. And that was a turning point, because, yes, we're survivors, and we can now turn our thoughts to other people that need to survive. There's still some people that came to our meetings that are still being defrauded, and they won't believe it.
They're coming to meetings,
yeah,
and they're still handing money over.
Yeah.
People want to believe the dream.
Yeah. No matter what you say, they won't listen. Oh, no, that can't happen to me. No, it's not right.
There are other kinds of romance fraud going on. A Russian bride scam that's going on at the moment. Tell me about that, please, Brian.
Well, again, it's the same scenario. It's simply a case of you're forming your relationship on the basis of that you're going to marry this person, and they'll come out and make you happy and take away your lonely lifestyle, and you'll provide them a better life in Australia than they have currently in Russia or some Eastern bloc country, former bloc country, and it's going to cost some money.
Sometimes a scam can drag the initial, the victim in and turn them into a perpetrator as well. Tell me a bit about the Maiden case and when the victim, sorry to use that word, I know, ended up as going to prison himself.
Yeah, we call it a second phase victimology, and that's where we see the huge losses. I mean, the millions seems to eventuate. So what happened is a person gets completely captivated by the story, and they exhaust all their own resources, all their cash. Their house might go under, the business might go under, people are now unemployed, and they have to extend the opportunity of a lifetime to others around them. And so they go to these other people and say, look, I'll let you in as a shareholder in this opportunity. Here are all the contracts I've got. You can see we're going to make a hell of a lot of money, and get those people involved. Now, we've had the situation where we've gone along to these people that have lost everything and getting others involved and said, look, this is a scam. This is a fraud. And we've provided warnings, multiple warnings. If you continue to get other people involved, you are committing the offence of fraud, because we have told you and shown you quite categorically that this is a fraudulent activity that you're party to. If you choose to ignore that, you will suffer the consequences of prosecution, and we don't want to do that. Please listen to us. Unfortunately, they continued. They went to the other investors and told them at one stage that we had actually endorsed that everything was fine, which was totally to the contrary, and when further people got involved because of the consequence of their actions, we were put in no other position but to charge them. And that was extremely unfortunate. We didn't want to do that.
Sometimes these cases get to the out-and-out weird. Tell me about the guy who traded his wife as collateral, Brian.
Look, this is really sad. This elderly gentleman, he with his second wife, I think it was, completely got again ensnared in one of these scenarios, lost all the money, went to a friend and said, can you please lend me X amount? And they came to a deal that his wife would now come and live with the friend as collateral for the loan. And the latest I've heard, when that happened, and the wife was a willing party to that, I might add. And
how can you offer a wife as collateral? What, you're going to hand her over as chattel? I mean, how does that she's going to be a bonded indentured slave or something like that? How does that work?
I didn't actually view the contract myself. But it goes, the last I heard was that the second male in the scenario lost all of his money as well.
Seniors seem to be particularly vulnerable in these matters. What? Older people have had a lifetime of experience where they can have enough experience, as Joan has, where she certainly learned to be able to see through the stories concocted by prisoners. They've got pretty good BS detectors, to put it in that sort of term. Why are they so easily targeted in this case?
Well, they're targeted because the seniors in this country hold the wealth. They hold the most money. We've got 1.6 trillion tied up in superannuation. The seniors in our country hold the wealth, and that's why they've been more actively targeted. They're the greatest demographic that's using the internet and probably the least prepared for it. We, as we've culturally, we believe people. We want to trust people because we should be trusted because we're honest folk. And the other side of the equation is we build up all of our relationships and our protective instincts based on the physical properties from face-to-face meetings with people, sight, sound, touch, smell. And, you know, if you met me for the first time, you'd probably say I wouldn't end up like the keys to my cars in a pink fit. However, if we communicate it online, all I'm communicating with you is by the written word, text. And we have a natural propensity to believe what we read. So, and it starts from when we first go to school. We're given books to read. So we believe what we read, but we may question what someone tells us face to face. And that's why this natural propensity is to... The written word carries far more weight sometimes.
And just finally, just briefly too, the next big thing that you see it.
Look,
it's going to come out of this weekend's announcement.
Well, look,
it?
The reality is the scammers sit back and watch current affairs and they watch what's happened in each country. You know, I'm told that after the Christchurch earthquake, within 6 hours, the first scam website was up and running. When we saw the banking fees, we saw scams on the phone saying, I'll get you some money back from the bank. I would anticipate with carbon trading now on the issue, be very wary of phone calls where these people are going to get you some carbon trade credits back. It's going to be your money that goes overseas.
Just some general rules here on when you think you may, when these people come knocking, just some general rules briefly on how to be, when to be suspicious.
Never give out information over a telephone when you call. Always be suspicious of a person that's overseas on the internet and never, ever, ever send cash overseas.
Never, ever do that.
Never, ever.
Ever do that. Cold calling, forget about it. Put them at arm's length. Anyone that's contacting you don't know via email, put them at arm's length, hold them right back.
They're suspicious at all times.
Yes, that's right, but you were suspicious at all times. That's the thing.
But as I said, I was still trying to help them. I had that feeling of, I can help. I'm an Australian. I'm open. That's the trouble. They're targeting Australians because we are good people and we don't like being hurt. So
it's been great to have you in. Thank you, Joan, for having the courage to speak up about this. Thank you so much,
Joan.
And Brian, hey, thank you for coming in as well.
My pleasure.
And if you need more information, please contact the Fraud Squad in your area, in the state you live in, for more information.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.